From the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week, on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, the federal government oversteps on curriculum, on free speech, and on shots for tots. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. During a House Judiciary Committee meeting earlier this week, the chief law enforcement officer of the federal government, Merrick Garland, was seemingly out of the loop on a few issues of national significance, not the least of which is his office's desire to see critical race theory taught in public schools, which is a clear conflict of interest for him. You'll see why in a moment. Joining Family Research Council President Tony Perkins on Thursday with more details on the hearing was Congressman Mike Johnson of Louisiana.
Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you, as always.
All right. Your line of questioning focused on whether the Attorney General sought ethics guidance before he issued his memo. Why did you ask that question?
Well, because it's a really important legal question. You know, this was a surprising hearing today for a number of reasons. Tony, as you know, it's the first time the Attorney General has appeared before the House Judiciary Committee. We have direct oversight over the Department of Justice. He's been in office for 7 months. This is the first time we had to ask him questions. We've sent a number of letters that we've not received responses to yet. So my question centered upon, as you noted, his directive to the school boards. And here's the central problem. There really is not only a political question here. It seems to have been a politicized decision to send that in response to a National School Board Association demand. But I believe more important than that is the ethics component. His son-in-law is widely reported now to be a co-founder, obviously a direct interest holder in this group called the Panorama Education Company. And what they do is they survey students across America, often without parental consent. And they use that in a bid to promote, get this, controversial curriculum about critical race theory and sexual identity and all these other matters. These are the very subjects, the very things that parents are going to school boards and protesting, registering their objection to. So for the Attorney General to step into the middle of this, insert the federal Department of Justice into a local and state matter, a local school board matter, and suggest that parents should not be doing that, raises a lot of questions about his family's financial interest in that very issue.
I mean, it certainly looks on its face as if there is a conflict of interest here, where you have the Attorney General of the United States, his son-in-law, selling curriculum to these schools across America on critical race theory, which, as you pointed out, is the focal point of a lot of these protests that are taking place at these local school boards. And he's simply, the Attorney General, it appears on his face that he's trying to intimidate parents and keep them from going to these school board meetings.
It does appear that way. And that's the problem under federal law. The Code of Federal Regulations is very clear on this. The Attorney General, remember, he's the chief law enforcement officer in our entire federal system. He's supposed to always jealously guard his character, the appearance of propriety. And so now people are questioning that. They believe that he is not being impartial, that he's using the full weight of that heavy office to bear down on parents for merely exercising their free exercise rights. But more importantly, it appears that his own daughter and son-in-law have a direct financial interest in stopping those parent protests. You know, it was interesting. I asked him the question multiple times. The clips of that hearing have been showed everywhere today because he dodged the question over and over. And Tony, he would not submit to a simple ethics review of what he has done. And I argue, and I think many people believe, that's a direct violation of the federal code of regulations.
So what was the outcome? Did he give a explanation justifying him not seeking this guidance?
No, that was one of the very surprising things about the hearing. He was one of the most ill-prepared witnesses that I've seen in my more than 20 years of law practice and questioning witness at the state legislative level and in Congress. It was very surprising. I mean, remember, he's the U.S. Attorney General, but he seemed ill-prepared to answer our questions. He delivered simple talking points over and over. And in response to that very serious series of questions that I asked about this big ethics issue, he delivered the same talking point over and over. It was truly surprising. He was saved by the bell because I ran out of time on the questions, but that is not going to be the end of this inquiry. A lot of people, I would say millions of Americans now, are on to this, and I think he'll have to answer to it sooner or later.
So, Congressman Johnson, what's the next step? Can the committee, being that the Republicans are in the minority, can anything be done here?
Well, look, we all have a responsibility of oversight over the DOJ, regardless of whether we're in the majority or minority party. And I can tell you, the Republicans will continue to press on these issues. We can't go any further than that, really, until we regain the majority next year, which I believe is almost a certainty now. But I can tell you that there will be a reckoning when we get the gavels back, because we have to do that. The point I made at the beginning of all this, and that many of us repeated all day, is that the American people are losing their faith in our system of justice. They're losing their faith in the Department of Justice, which is supposed to uphold the Constitution. But instead of addressing all these pressing matters that are facing the country, they're weaponizing the DOJ. It's a terrible, terrible development, and it has huge implications for so many aspects of the federal government.
Well, I know you have to run. I appreciate you joining us with an analysis of today's hearing. And I will just say this. I think it's an important point to put these officials on the record and on notice, rather, that if the Republicans do retake the majority, which it does appear that that's in the works, that they will be held accountable. That may temper some of their actions between now and 2022. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate all you do.
All right. Congressman Mike Johnson of Louisiana. Now, while the Attorney General's memo on the threat posed by concerned parents sparked much of the fireworks at today's hearing, that wasn't the only thing discussed. Joining me now to talk about what else came up during today's hearing is Dave. We have Dave Boyer. He is a White House correspondent at The Washington Times. He'll be joining us in just a moment. But I want to emphasize the fact that when you look at the arrogance of this administration, there's a real dangerous time between now and when the Republicans may retake the majority, which all the polling and the policies being pushed by the Democratic majority would suggest is going to happen, very similar to what happened back in 2009. But in this period of uncertainty and desperation, I think the Democrats could push all kinds of bad things through, which is why we've been talking about the reconciliation bill, stuff they've been trying to do for decades. And so that's why we're watching very closely where they would eliminate the legislative filibuster and other matters that could fundamentally change government in our country. Well, joining us now is Dave Boyer. He's White House correspondent. Correspondent at the Washington Times. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So we were just talking with Congressman Mike Johnson about the exchange he had over the ethics issues, but there were other issues beyond the memo regarding parental involvement in education. What were the other big issues that came up in Attorney General Merrick Garland's first appearance before the House Judiciary Committee?
Well, a lot of Republican lawmakers were concerned about what they perceive as his lack of action on immigration and border security and the administration's lack of control of the border in general. The Justice Department does control immigration judges who issue deportation orders, and they were pressing the Attorney General about what exactly he's doing to deport people who have been arrested for, you know, being in the country illegally. He didn't seem to have any good answers to that. He kept deflecting it. Well, that's a Homeland Security question. And to a large extent, he's right, but he also has a role to play. And he didn't seem completely up to speed on that. One of the more interesting things I thought was a Congressman Ken Buck from Colorado, a Republican, really did an effective job, I think, of pushing for a special counsel to investigate Hunter Biden's art sales. Didn't get a lot of attention in the media today, but Ken Buck from Colorado really laid out a very convincing case for why this needs some scrutiny. The art gallery in New York got federal disaster loans from the Small Business Administration, and now Hunter Biden's artwork is selling for up to $500,000 a painting, and he's under investigation already for tax fraud by the IRS and the Justice Department. And, you know, the Attorney General just kind of threw up his hands and said, well, I'll take it under advisement, but I can't comment on anything like that.
Yeah, I actually watched Congressman Buck in that exchange. At the beginning, in the opening statement by the chairman, Jerry Nadler, you know, he claimed that there was a broader pattern that led to the increased violence across the country. He was talking about the January 6th riot. He said, from the riot to the increased attacks against Asian Americans during the pandemic to the growing threats of violence against public servants. I was just going to ask you, did he mention the riots in 2020? You know, plural, businesses and federal buildings that were looted and burned, or did he just begin with January 6th as his reference point for violence?
No, he didn't mention those riots during the George Floyd summer of protests at all, and the mayhem and the destruction that was caused. He was just starting with a timeline of January 6th and moving on from there, and very much portraying the civil unrest as a you know, one-sided partisan sort of a, you know, the white supremacist, neo-Nazi kind of extremist on the right problem.
Dave, we're out of time, but one final question for you. Was it just me, or did this look like it was a pretty tense hearing?
Yes, I think you're right. It was tense. And I think the Attorney General came across as someone who's, you know, obviously it's a big job, but he came across as someone who still hasn't mastered his department.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave Boyer, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for giving us an overview of today's hearing.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage of today's hearing and get Congressman Chip Roy's take on what came out and what didn't. He got, a surprising admission from the Attorney General. He shares it with us next. Don't go away.
Have you ever tried to read the Bible daily, but struggled to get in a groove? It can be hard, especially if you don't know where to start, or how to understand and apply what you've read. Or maybe it's just that doing it alone has made it too easy to give up. Well, let me encourage you. You don't have to do this daily discipline alone. You can join Family Research Council's Stand on the Word 2-year Bible reading plan. Let's stay grounded in God's truth and grow closer to God together. Sign up today by visiting frc.org/Bible.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, tonyperkins.com. Check it out. All right. During today's hearing on the oversight of the Justice Department, Attorney General Merrick Garland on multiple occasions claimed that his memo about concerned parents dealt with violence. But notably, the arrest highlighted in the National School Boards Association's letter to President Biden, which the Attorney General admitted he read and based his memo on, had nothing to do with any threat or violence against school board members. And even the Attorney General had to admit that the father who was arrested would not be considered a threat, though the NSBA would.
When this statement bothered the father of the girl, I'm a father of a daughter, I believe you are too, sir. The girl who had been raped, sodomized in the bathroom of a high school by a dude wearing a skirt, that father reacted. Now, that father reacted by simply using a derogatory word. Would that statement have bothered you if your daughter had been raped, if somebody said that it didn't occur?
Again, I don't know anything about the facts of this case, but derogatory words are not what my memorandum is about.
With me now is the congressman who pressed the attorney general on the case in Virginia's Loudoun County, Congressman Chip Roy. He represents the 21st Congressional District of Texas and actually has ties to Loudoun County. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Tony, great to be on the show as always.
Actually, you grew up there in Loudoun County, so you're familiar with the area.
Yeah. Despite longtime Texas roots dating back to the 1850s, my mom and dad moved up to that neck of the woods in Northern Virginia. And so I grew up in Loudoun County proudly. It was a great school. I was very blessed. But back then, we were a pretty rural, conservative school. We certainly weren't engaging in the kind of activities that we're seeing now unfold in Loudoun, sadly, and that we're now seeing the FBI being empowered by the Attorney General through political pressure from the White House that we now know were coordinated with leftist organizations to try to put pressure to politicize this and have the FBI targeting parents. And I was glad to see my colleague Jim Jordan press the Attorney General today to get the Attorney General to acknowledge that they they actually engaged in that endeavor as a result of that memorandum from the liberals with this National School Boards Association. And then your friend and mine, Mike Johnson, did an extraordinary job hammering the attorney general on the conflicts of interest with his own son on critical race theory. So we got a lot out of the hearing today.
Now, Congressman Roy, I thought you brought out an astonishing admission from the attorney general when you presented this situation in Loudoun County, which is referenced in the National School Board letter, which he said he read and prompted him to send out his memo launching this task force, that he admitted he had no idea about the case you were asking him about, which is at the center of the National School Boards Association's letter.
Yeah, well, I have been in modest communication with the father of that young lady. Obviously our prayers go out to them. I always hate, the reason I've been in communication is because I don't like to politicize things. This is a human being. This is a little girl. But they understand the importance of this. This is why he went to the school board in July. But yet he was ridiculed. He was turned into the poster child for so-called domestic terrorism. But what we now know is that that memorandum put forward by the National Association of School Boards, which is very left-leaning, we now know through FOIA requests from some organizations like Parents Defending Education, they did the FOIA request and they found out and saw that the White House had been coordinating with this organization for weeks, for a long time, leading up to the September 29th memorandum. That then 5 days later, the attorney general then put out a directive to the FBI to go target parents for this so-called domestic terrorism. And in that memo, footnote 13 directly cites to the Loudoun County case. And it was those outside organizations that were, you know, putting out images of this man, Scott Smith, as a domestic terrorist for daring to just show up and exercise his First Amendment rights at a school board about his daughter who had been raped in the school that he sent her to be educated in. I mean, just saying a few words is on the low side of what I might have been doing in that circumstance.
So the evidence is now out through the FOIA that there was collusion between the White House and this leftist organization, the National School Boards Association.
Yep.
That, in fact, I mean, when you read their letter, I think it was a 6-page letter that they sent to President Biden, calling on everything from the Patriot Act to be used and utilized to go after these parents. It was clear that the White House's fingerprints, the Biden administration's fingerprints, were all over that letter.
Yeah, and I frankly, I don't accept that the attorney general can just sort of stumble his way through it saying, oh, well, this is just a state and local issue. I don't know the facts. I mean, that's bogus, right? First of all, you had the memo that connected it back to Loudoun, that your organization, the attorney general's office, the Department of Justice, made the decision based upon. But also, you're now engaging in saying the FBI should be inserting itself into what are inherently state and local matters, right? The disagreements that a parent might have with a school board. If there's any kind of violence, great. The local law enforcement can say it was a crime committed, and then they can go prosecute the crime. Why is the Department of Justice getting involved? Because it's political. You inserted the Department of Justice into state and local activities, and then you try to claim that you don't know the facts of the very underlying state and local activity upon which you base your determination to engage. It defies any kind of common sense, and I think now we see why it's a good thing that Mr. Garland is not on the United States Supreme Court.
So, Congressman Chip Roy, last question for you. What's next? How do we follow up on this? What are the next steps?
Well, obviously, we're going to be following up with further questions of the Department of Justice. I think now that we've got this information, we got it late today about the information from the FOIA request showing that the White House had been coordinating with it. We're going to lean into that and make sure our Senate colleagues, the next time they've got a chance to ask questions. And we're going to have parents continue to do what they're doing. I mean, God bless you, Tony. You were out in Leesburg a few weeks back. I couldn't make it. But we've got parents all over this country that are awakening to what's been happening with critical race theory, what's happening with this transgender nonsense they're trying to force down the throats of the American people. And the American people aren't having it. And that's the best way to hold everybody accountable. Yeah. It doesn't take a majority. Takes a minority willing to set brush fires of freedom. That's Sam Adams, and I know you know that. Yes. So we're gonna keep fighting for it.
It's a team effort, and we appreciate all that you and your colleagues are doing on Capitol Hill, and we'll keep doing our part. And I'm prayerful and hopeful parents will continue to do theirs as well. Chip, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
God bless you, my friend.
All right, coming up, the White House has set its target on 28 million children who have not yet gotten COVID shots. It's shots for tots. We're going to talk about it next. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
More than ever, Christians need to be grounded in the truth of God's Word and be prepared to articulate them. That is why Family Research Council has launched the Center for Biblical Worldview. By applying the Bible and the historical teachings of the Church to a wide range of relevant issues, including voting, religious liberty, abortion, marriage, and sexuality, experts at the Center have provided resources to help Christians live by a biblical worldview. To access the Center's free resources, go to frc.org/worldview.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, yesterday, the Biden administration rolled out its Shots for Tots plan to get COVID shots into children ages 5 to 11, though it still has to wait for the go-ahead from the Food and Drug Administration, probably just a formality. Already, the administration has procured enough shots for every one of the 28 million children that they've identified in the country. And it's just simply waiting for the final green light. They already have a distribution plan out there. And that could, the approval could come as early as the first week in November. Surgeon General, I'm looking for my notes here, but we've got a clip. I want to play that clip of the Surgeon General.
I also think that parents across the country have been waiting for a vaccine for a long time and are eager that this moment may be close.
Now, the question is, and I'm sure there may be some parents that are eager to get this vaccine, although I'm not quite sure that it's 28 million parents or the parents of 28 million children are eager for this. But the question is, will this lead to another mandate? And also, what about side effects, consequences? Is that being considered here when we talk about children? Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Andrew Bostom. He's a clinical trialist and associate professor of family medicine at Brown University. Dr. Bostom, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me back on, Tony.
All right, let me just ask you this question straight up. The Biden administration rolling out this plan, they've already procured 28 million doses to be able to vaccinate these children, give children these shots. Do we know enough about this yet?
Absolutely not. What we do know is that children in this age range, with exceedingly rare exceptions, kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities, maybe kids that unfortunately are morbidly obese, perhaps, healthy children have close to zero risk from developing serious COVID illness, and in fact, they're at significantly higher risk from both seasonal flu and certainly pandemic flu. And yet we've never seen any sort of draconian mandates, whether it's mask mandates, vaccine mandates. I just don't understand this. And on top of that, Tony, the limited data we have for vaccination in children tells us nothing about long-term consequences. And frankly, because you know, when you're looking at clinical trial data, Tony, you have to have clinical outcomes. And because they're so rare in children, we have these, you know, meaningless surrogates, like, you know, did the kid develop basically a sniffles or not? And was that reduced in the vaccinated group versus the unvaccinated group? When we get down to this age range, it's usually just the development of an antibody response that they've tracked in the studies that have been done. So, I think this is a profound mistake. The vaccination program should be targeting high risk populations. When you winnow it down in kids, you probably could identify a few, but they would be exceedingly rare. And they should be studied separately in an appropriate randomized controlled trial, which would actually look at whether or not you prevented serious COVID illness in high-risk children, hospitalization, et cetera. And we don't have any of this data.
Well, I'm sure it's safe to assume that the Biden administration, within the Biden administration, there's consensus that this is what they need to do. But what about in the medical community? Is there consensus that we need to vaccinate children or give children the COVID shot?
There's certainly not consensus, but there, unfortunately, I would say there's not enough dissenting voices to just slow down the momentum, which is really been a tragedy of this whole pandemic. There are certainly people that will speak out, and there have been pediatricians that will speak out, but it's the sad story, the sad reality, Tony, is that they're in the minority.
Dr. Bossom, is there a reason for that? Do we see the weight of kind of the cancel culture coming down on those minority voices?
Yeah, I'll give you a very concrete example. So there was a wonderful study done out of Sweden during the first wave in Sweden. If you recall, Tony, Sweden kept its schools open through age 16. Children were unmasked in school. Obviously, there was no vaccine. And they didn't report during the first wave a single pediatric death. And this was written up as a research letter to the New England Journal of Medicine by a pediatrician/pediatrician epidemiologist. It was a very clear, concise study with a strong message that children do well with this disease. And that they don't need to be kept out of school, et cetera. The investigator was so pilloried by his colleagues that he wrote an open letter and said he would never do research on COVID again. This is the environment that people face.
Wow, amazing. And I thought we were supposed to follow the science.
Exactly.
And see what the science says. Dr. Bossom, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us. I look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.